go into each other. Essentially, the third Aliyah is largely about the contrast and the separation, the physical separation and the theological separation between Avraham and Lot. So the Torah tells us that at first Avraham and Lot were together, and Avraham became very wealthy, and Lot became wealthy because of him. And then things started to get tense, and they started to fight, and their shepherds started to fight with each other. And Rav Soloveitchik has an essay about this, one of the svarim that has come out in recent years, long after Soloveitchik's passing. One of the more recent volumes is called Abraham's Journey. It's a whole book about Avraham Avinu. So he has a section here which highlights the fact that really there was nothing that they had to really fight about, and if it's about land, you can always get more land, and you can always work it out. But the issue is that Avraham and Lot had become theologically different, that Lot had picked up the values of Mitzrayim, Lot had become very driven by money, and Avraham was on a theological mission to be Makari of the world and to bring Shem Hashem and the notion of God into the world. As some suggest, that's actually the theme of the whole Parsha, at the very beginning of the Parsha, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, that you should leave your land, is actually a way of saying you should leave your concerns of Olam Hazeh and stop, not that Avraham was inclined this way anyway, but understand that your life is going to be a spiritual one, even though you will be wealthy, but it's all towards the goal of the spiritual mission.
And Lot, a non-Zionistic way to look at it.
Well, that's a part of it also. You know, that Lech Me'artzecha, it still says, either way, it's Lech Lecha Me'artzecha. The question is, what's he going to for? So he's going to Eretz Yisrael for the purpose of spreading God's mission. And Lot's not interested in being a part of that, really. That's not what Lot is about. So there's an ideological division. There is a split here that's happening between them. And it manifests itself in terms of fights. And it's interesting, so there is a pasuk here where it talks about this fight. The pasuk says, pasuk Zayin, Vahiriv ben roe mikne Avram, ben roe mikne Lot, vahaknani vahaprizi, oz yoshev ba'aretz. That at that time, the Knani and the Prizi were also in the land. So why does the Torah tell us about that? So Soloveitchik, in his essay, he says that this is getting to become a greater and greater divide between them, and Avraham didn't want it to get any worse. At the end of the day, their blood, at the end of the day, their family, and there will always be some kesher, but that kesher is still going to be strained by these major differences. He didn't want it to get any worse. So let's part ways now before we have to really fight each other. And the idea that there were onlookers, so to speak, that there were Kanani and there were Prizi that were in the land, the Rav thought that was there to say that if people are going to catch on what's going on between us, so I'm going to be forced to take a stand. I'm going to be forced to publicly debate you and to fight you about your value system. And I don't want to have to do that. I want to try to preserve whatever's left of our relationship. And therefore, let's part amicably at this time. Rashi has a different notion here, that this is to tell us that the part of the fight that was going on is that Lot was essentially stealing, that he was letting his animals graze on the land under the assumption or under the claim that it's Avram's land, so therefore he's allowed to, as part of the family, he's allowed to graze on that land as well. But the truth is, it wasn't all yet Avram's land. Some of it was not. And that's what the pasuk is telling us, that there were others who were there who also had a claim to the land. And this is, as far as I point out, that those who have the impression that it's permissible to steal from non-Jews, you see clearly that's not what's going on. That clearly, even though it's Canaan and Prism who are very much diametrically opposed to Avram's value system and religion, but nonetheless, it's still not right to steal from them, and Avram stopped Lot from engaging in this kind of behavior. So, Sefer Oros Yitzchak, temporary Sefer, where he suggested also that there was a concern of Chil Hashem, because we're also, Chazal also tell us that Avram and Lot had a family resemblance. They looked very much alike. So since Lot was misbehaving in his way, since Lot was stealing, Avram was concerned about the Chil Hashem. He was concerned that people would think that Avram was engaging in this kind of behavior. They wouldn't be able to tell them apart. So therefore, he felt he really had to distance himself and really had to break up. So Lot becomes a part of stone, and Avram follows his path. And the contrast between the two of them is very much a theme of the Aliyah, is very much a theme of the Parsha. The Shiv Kerembi Avner of Goldwicht has a fascinating essay about the whole character of Lot and how exactly he had transformed and how he hadn't transformed. That here you have Lot, who grew up with Avram, who was given values by Avram and was given value, was given monetary value. All of his wealth came from Avram. But nonetheless, you see how when he picked up this notion of being so focused on materialism, that it had a very destructive impact, and it shifted his ability to make decisions. So he has, in the course of this essay, that the Medrash says that what is it that was the schus that allowed Lot to be saved from the destruction of the stone? It's because he saved Avram's life. How? Because when Avram had told Sarah to pretend that she was his sister, so Lot could have blew the cover. Lot could have told the truth and said what was going on, and he would have endangered Avram. But he was quiet, so for that schus, he's able to get rescued. He's rescued because of that. So the Rashi would comment, if you think about this, what's going on here, right? Here, this is his uncle, who made him everything that he is, who is his blood relative, who made him wealthy, who gave him great kindness and great support, so he would turn him in. So apparently, yes, apparently his desire for monetary profit was such that when he thought that he could gain by getting in good with the Egyptians, so he was tempted to do that. But okay, he had enough hakar satov still, he had enough respect that he held back, that he didn't say anything. So he commented, Goldwicht, that this is reflective of the very famous principle that Rav Dessler has in his Sefer Michtav Melio. So Rav Dessler talks about the fact that we believe in Bechira Chashis, right? We believe that a person has free will. That's one of the major principles of Jewish Emunah. But free will is not always absolute. Free will is something that shifts based on the decisions that you make and the circumstances that you put yourself in. So it's not always the case that at any given moment you have the ability to choose any path. Sometimes you make decisions that take you so far along a certain path that your range of choices is much more limited. And sometimes you behave in such a way that you created patterns for yourself that you're no longer deciding from moment to moment which path you're going to take. You've already put yourself on that path because of all your previous decisions. That's what he calls the Nekudas HaBechira, that we all have a point at which we make our decisions. And different people are at different points along the spectrum. A guy in yeshiva is not necessarily deciding whether or not he's going to learn Torah. He'll decide smaller details. What time will he come? How intensely will he learn? While somebody who's part of a criminal gang is making very different decisions every day. The patterns that you set for yourself have created realities where decisions that you make flow from that. So you see that here, Lot had reached such a point where his desire for money and his desire for material gain was such that what's his big success? That he was able to hold himself back from turning his uncle in to be killed. That's the big madriga that he was at. That he was. That was the decision, should he turn his uncle in or not? And he didn't do that, so for that he gets rewarded. But at the same time, we see that even once he moves to stone, where the value system is very, very different, still the hachnasas orchim quality that he got from Uncle Avram, that's so deeply embedded in him that it was still going to be a part of his practice. That was still something that he couldn't give up on. And that also has to do with, again, these embedded values and these embedded attitudes that we're not always making a choice one way or another. So on the one hand, his great desire for materialism is putting him in a certain context. And at the same time, his history of chesed still has a lingering effect that you can't take that component out of him even when he ends up residing in stone. So I mentioned to some people that there is a fascinating halachic topic that is kind of beneath the surface here. I was talking to Ari before to try to guess what the topic was. He came up with a couple, actually, but one interesting halachic topic, which is not explicit in the parsha, but is a very important one, and that is indicated here as much as it is anywhere else, is that the pasuk says, in the middle of talking about all this, V'anshei Sdom Roim V'chatoim L'Hashem Mod. They were very bad people. The people of Sdom were very bad and were great sinners. So what did they do? So we have different statements in Chazal what they do. To some extent, it had to do with Arayos, that they had all kinds of activities in that area of life. And in modern English, it's invoked in that context as well. But there's another whole element which is less obviously evil, but is apparently associated with Sdom. And it's important because it affects halacha l'maaseh. That we find that we have an attitude throughout Shas that we are told not to be like Sdom. And therefore, we have to figure out what does that mean. So what is Midas Sdom? So you can look first to the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah in the fifth parak of Pirkei Avos tells us that there are different qualities a person could have. That there are some people who think what's mine is mine and what's mine is yours. What's mine is yours and what's yours is yours. What's mine is mine and what's yours is mine. It's not such an impressive attitude. And then the Mishnah says, what if you have somebody who says what's mine is mine? And what's yours is yours. Shali, shali, v'shalcha, shalcha. So what would you think of such a person? So Mishnah says, Harei zeh mida beinonis. That's an average person. He's not impressively generous. He's not looking to give of his stuff to others. But he's also not a ganav. He's not looking to take away from other people. So that's a beinoni quality. But the Mishnah has another opinion that says, no, Harei zeh mida stom. So what does that mean? That person who says what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours is a midas stone? That's such a terrible attitude to have? That a person who believes very much in property rights, that everybody should have what they're entitled to, me get what I want and you get what you want, what you have, what I'm entitled to, you get what you're entitled to, that's such a terrible thing? So we have to figure out exactly what that Mishnah is talking about. It's interesting, there's a little bit of a machlokas harishonim what the Mishnah really means. The Bartanura and a few others say it doesn't really mean that that itself is Midas Sdom, but it means that that type of attitude could take you to Midas Sdom, that that's very close to the behavior of Sdom. And the other Rishonim interpreted it a little bit more directly, and they say, no, that is Midas Sdom. This attitude of what's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours, that's the quality of Sdom. So Rashi in Maseches Ksubas interprets the quality of Sdom as meaning that you don't want others to benefit from your property, even when it's not going to cost you anything, even if it's not going to take anything away from you, but you are so absolute about property that you're not going to take away from his, but no one else should benefit from yours, and not only that they shouldn't take away from you, but even if it would be such a scenario where there would be no chisaron to you, there'd be no lack to you, you don't want other people to benefit, that Rashi says is Midas Sdom. It's important to understand in general when we talk about chesed and tzedakah and the like, that we do have a strong focus on the midah, on the quality of generosity and the like. This is a major theme, for example, in Parshas Re'eh. So the Torah tells us that we have an obligation to give tzedakah. And in that context, the Torah also records prohibitions. Seems like two prohibitions. Tosus and Maseches Ksubos and Daf Mem Tes points out there's two prohibitions in not giving tzedakah. Lo sikbot es yadcha, you shouldn't close your fist. Lo yisa'amet es levavcha, you shouldn't harden your heart. And it sounds like from the Torah that if you refuse to give tzedakah, if somebody asks you for tzedakah and you say no, that you're in violation of not only one, but two prohibitions, which is very scary. It's like saying that if anybody asks you for tzedakah and you say no, it's like you're eating chazer and wearing Shabbos at the same time. That's a pretty scary thought. So how do we deal with that? Because all of us are confronted with situations where we're asked for tzedakah and we say no, we simply can't address every need. So it's not a simple topic, it is a discussion in general, but there are some who say, and this resonates strongly, that the Torah is not really saying you can never say no to a request for tzedakah. The Torah is formulating a certain specific attitude. There are all kinds of reasons why somebody might say no to a tzedakah request. Maybe you don't have enough money. Maybe you have other tzedakah priorities. Maybe you don't trust this person. Maybe you have whatever other legitimate reason not to give tzedakah. The Gemara has a sentence that sounds kind of cynical. The Gemara says that we should be grateful to the Ramah, and we should be grateful to the fact that there are dishonest people in this world, because they save us from being judged negatively. Because when we refuse requests for tzedakah, and we say, well, because who knows how honest this person is, so we're, so to speak, in a cynical sense, we're lucky that there are dishonest people in the world. We can blame it on them, that we didn't give tzedakah because we're worried about the dishonest people. But if everybody was honest and every request was a legitimate request, we'd have a harder time justifying not giving tzedakah. But in any event, the fact is that there are different levels of reliability and different levels of priority, and we have limited resources, so there are good reasons not to give tzedakah. So many understood that if you don't give to a request for one of those reasons, okay, so fine, so that's legitimate. But if a person doesn't give tzedakah because, like the literal reading of the Pesukim in Re'eh, well, Sikpo Tzesiyot V'Sameis L'Vavcha, he hardens his heart, he says, so other people's problems are not my problems. Essentially, Shalit Shalit V'Shalcha Shalcha, you have yours and I have mine, you worry about your problems, I'll worry about my problems. So that attitude is a un-Jewish attitude. That attitude is a complete betrayal of God's values, and that's a betrayal of the tradition of Avraham Avinu. So again, this is very much a theme. It's not tangential that we have Sdom and Avraham contrasted so sharply in the Parsha, and at this stage of our history, that the values that Avraham Avinu are going to represent, especially coming up in Vayera and this Parsha as well, is a stark contrast to the Midah of Sdom. Sdom is about, you don't want anyone to benefit from you, Davka, because you don't believe that there's any reason for that. You don't believe that anyone else should benefit, not because you have any kind of good excuse, you can't afford it, etc., etc. Not even because you want to indulge in luxuries, but because, well, why should you give to anyone else? That's the way Rashi defines it in Ksubis, that you have this kind of attitude. So you find a couple of places in the Gemara that there is a notion of kofin al midah stone, which seems to mean that the literal translation is that Bezdin will compel, will coerce, and the way some of the posts can understand it means they will physically coerce, like they have their enforcement powers, that a person should not act in this way. A person should not act with midas stone. So what's interesting, just to reflect a little bit, that there's another phrase that appears in the Gemara, sometimes in conjunction with this phrase, and sometimes not, and sometimes Rishonim link them. And you have to figure out if they always mean the same thing. The Gemara has an expression, Zenene v'zelo chaser. One person benefits and the other person doesn't lack. So this is used in different contexts. So just to consider what some of the contexts are, just to give two of the major sugyas where one or the other of these phrases shows up. So, for example, there is a Gemara in Maseches Bava Kama, and Chaf, Amar Aleph, Tamid Beis, where the Gemara talks about Hadar B'chatzer Chaveiro Shalom Midaito. Sorry? So that's what I'm not 100% confident that's the case. Some Rishonim link the two sugyas together, and I think there is room to wonder if they're always the same thing. I think there's different forms, but we'll lay it out. That the Gemara over there, Bava Kama, says, let's say, for example, you're on vacation, and you come back from vacation, and your neighbor tells you, oh, you know, it's good that while you were away for a few weeks, things were, my house, I had a plumbing issue in my house, or it was leaking in my house, So I spent a few nights in your guest room. So he had the keys, whatever it is, he was able to get in. So you say to him, you slept in my house? My house is like the Waldorf Astoria. That's $700 a night. So I want to charge you $2,100 for the three nights that you slept there. So the Gemara says he's not allowed to do that. He's not allowed to charge this individual because, first of all, he is not a hotel, meaning he doesn't have a business where he is charging people to sleep in the house. That's an important detail. The Gemara says it's not kain mula agra. He doesn't use this as a revenue stream normally. So what this person did is called zenene v'zelo chaser, that he enjoyed. He slept in the room for a few nights. But it didn't cost the owner of the house anything. There's no chisar, and he still has his house. It's in perfect shape. And it's a little bit hard to relate to some of these cases because you could, if you imagine it in real life, you imagine there would be some kind of a chisar that would come from such an arrangement. But we'll have to assume abstractly that there's absolutely no cost whatsoever to this guy. The guy cleaned up after himself. He called in a maid service afterwards and had everything cleaned and washed and whatever it is. There's no loss whatsoever to the owner of the house. And under those circumstances, he doesn't have the right to say, okay, I'm charging you rent, l'mafreya. Michael, you were going to ask about that? All right, so again, it's a little bit more theoretical because in real life, it's a little bit hard to imagine scenarios happening like that where there's really no concern whatsoever. But for the purpose of the discussion, you have to imagine a scenario where the guy availed himself of this person's property and did so in a way that didn't cost him anything, didn't cost him a cent. Amir? Right, that's also why I can say why it gets kind of hard to imagine real life, because is there really no privacy violation? Is there really no suffering at all that was imposed on this person? So let's try to paint the picture as abstractly as possible. He has a guest room where he invites outsiders into all the time, and he happened not to have invited this guy, and he doesn't charge for it ever, and this guy decided on his own he's going to use it. So after the fact, the owner says, I'm charging you. Shlomo?
I know this is, it's more like a lot of homeless and then end of the chaser, but what would you say about a sports stadium and someone buying a bleacher seat and then seeing that there was a seat lower down and no one is sitting there, you know?
That's important again to clarify. There could be aspects of that which may depend on a little bit the reality of how the stadiums work, but in general, with a scenario like that, we're not really going to have this kind of application because they sell those seats. So anything that's kain mula agra, or anything that's done for business purposes that stands there, that's exists to be rented out. So let's say if somebody snuck into the actual Waldorf Astoria and they found out afterwards, found out a month later, the guy spent three nights there and didn't charge. So then for sure they charge him because it's a hotel, they charge for the rooms. So the Gemara is clear in this case that the person does not charge for the rooms. So then it's not normally a revenue stream. Right, so that's a key difference. Again, the details of the stadium, there might be what to talk about, but just it's not totally comparable to this kind of case. So, hi.
What about if you go into the Waldorf Astoria and just go to like use the amenities? You go by the pool, which they're not directly charged, like they don't charge for it per se. Like,
it probably depends which amenities those are, so it also depends which hotel. You know, there are certain amenities which they do open to the public. The pool, it would seem, is really only open to their paying guests, usually, so theoretically, if somebody were to breach that, you know, they have to figure out what it's worth.
But you know, it,
right? It's not the same value. They have to probably be a lower value, although you have to figure out exactly how they calculate it. But if they wanted to charge you, they would have the right to say, "This is part of what we use as our business, and it's a service we give to paying customers. So it's essentially a business stream, and yeah, we could charge you for that." So that's one case. And there, the Gemara doesn't have the phrase there, kofin on midas dom, if I remember correctly. But there are Rishonim who invoke it in that context. Rishonim who comment on that Gemara. And you find the same cross-referencing in the Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra on Daf Yud Beis, where there the Gemara talks about, let's say you have two brothers who inherit some land together. So the brothers have to divide up the land. So normally, you have something like this, how would you divide it up? You'd probably take a goral, you'd have a lottery system to decide, okay, here's plot A, here's plot B, this brother gets plot A, this brother gets plot B, and we'll just make it somewhat random. But let's say you have one brother who says that the property is going to be divided up into the south side and the north side, and I have a house, already have land on the south side. So it's much more valuable to me to get the land that's on the south side, because it'll be next to my property, and I'll have a bigger, a more valuable property. And the other brother, it makes no difference. The two halves that are of equal value, so it doesn't make a difference to him which one he gets. So the brother who already has the adjoining land, should he be able to say, listen, skip the goral, I want the land that's closest to me. So that the Gemara invokes there the phrase, kofen on midas don, where there again he finds that nene vizelo chaser, but it's a little bit of a different usage, that it would be a hana to one brother to get the land that's close to his property, while it's not a chasaro to the other brother, because it doesn't make a difference. The two plots are equally valuable. So the Gemara invokes that phrase, kofen on midas don, over there, although it's not clear that that's halacha l'maisa. The Gemara goes back and forth about the reality of such a situation, because we're working off the premise that these two plots of land are identical. Come on, what do you care? Just give me the one that's closer to mine. And the Gemara gives cases, well, the brother or other brother might say, no, I prefer this, I prefer that, where there might be some detail of a reality where maybe there's a reason for the other brother to say he's not so willing to pass up on this. And it's a machlokas also, and we're showing him how exactly we paskin on that question. And we'll get to that maybe a little more in a second. But that's another example where this idea of kofen al midas stone is invoked. So it's an interesting question. Are these two cases the same? Well, say, let's call both these cases zenen nevezel ochaser. Are they the same type of zenen nevezel ochaser? So it's an interesting question. There are some who see them in the same breath as basically the same kind of notion, that one guy could benefit and the other person doesn't lose anything, so what's the big deal? But they strike me as a little bit different in terms of the midas don considerations, because the situation of the guy who owns the house and he wants to charge, so, okay, he's not allowed to charge. He's not entitled to rent for this. But the fact that he wants the rent, that's not necessarily automatically stone-like. Okay, he wants money. Everybody wants money. That's a normal quality to want money. He's not entitled to the money. Okay, so he didn't do anything to earn the money because he didn't set up a business arrangement and he didn't lose anything. So he's not entitled to the money. But the desire for money is not by its nature necessarily stone-like, perhaps. But in the case in Baba Basra, we say Zenen Vizelo Chaser, we mean that you're preventing the other person from benefiting in a situation where it wouldn't make a difference to you. So that's more about achzarius. That seems to be more about cruelty, if that's really the situation. It's not like you have the potential to make money here. You're basically just trying to make the other guy lose out. So we could see more why in that context you might invoke the idea of kofin al midas don, because you might say to act that way, just to spite the other guy or just to deprive the other person of benefit that doesn't have any impact on you, that's a cruel attitude that is different from what we want a Jew to be. So we say, kofen al midas don. Shlomo, you had a question?
Yeah, but it's not true.
So it's an interesting question whether these two sugyas are really the same and to what extent they're parallel to each other. The idea of kofen al midas don, by the way, most Rishonim assume is a din daraisa. It's a question of daraisa, not from this pasuk, doesn't say anything here. But the attitude, well, if they're linked, you know, then it seems like it's all the right question of where it comes from. Some say it comes from V'yahavt Kamocha. Some say it comes from Sedek Tirdof. A different suggestion of what exactly it's tied to in terms of a mucker. But it seems to be an attitude daraisa. Tosus mentions aspects of it being drabanan in certain circumstances. But the general idea seems to be a din daraisa, and certainly a value daraisa. Again, this section of the Torah is where we're really being taught what our basic brachos as a whole, our whole history from the Avos, we're being taught our fundamental value system. So here, on a very key level, this has to do with our basic values. So it's an interesting question whether these two Gemaras are really revolving around the same point or not. Has important ramifications of the halacha, I think. For example, I had a very revered teacher here, Rabbi Levine Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who suggested the following din. That he said that, let's say you're driving somewhere and somebody wants a ride with you and you're going there anyway. So it doesn't cost, you agree to take him, and it doesn't cost you anything more. He's going the exact same path, etc., etc. So he assumes that that's basically like Hadar B'chatzu Chavero, that you're not allowed to charge the guy for that. If, let's say, you know, two people are both going to the same place, and they realize they're going to the same place, they say, why should we drive two separate cars? Let's go together and split the gas and split the tolls or whatever. They make that deal in advance. So then fine, they're entitled to do that. But that's not the case. You're on your way already, and you realize that your friend is going there also, so you give him a ride, and you were all ready to pay all the tolls and all the gas. So he's not adding anything to your costs. So fine, you're not allowed to charge the person. That seems to be in the category of Hadar B'chatz Chaveiro Shalom Midaito. But Rabbi Levine went a step further, and he said, not only are you not allowed to demand payment, but what happens if the guy says, you know what, I appreciate the ride, let me chip in a little bit for the gas, whatever, I'll pay you something. So he thought, you're not even allowed to accept an offer, because that's what's conveyed by the idea of kofin al midas dom. That sentence, that strong sentence, is a way of saying that it's not just unjustified, it's not just that you don't have a right to the money, but that it's repulsive, that it's completely antithetical to Jewish values to take money for that. And that's, even if a person offers, one should not accept. So one could argue, I'll take a second, one could argue that that's going a little bit far, that it seems that we really have two different sugyas here. We have the sugya where a person is cruel to someone else, just wants to deprive him of a benefit without any impact on himself. And the case where somebody wants to charge someone else, even though he didn't really lose anything to justify the charge. So while they both might be called Zenen and Vazel Al-Chaser, but they don't necessarily both have the Midas Dom component to the same degree. So to say that not only are you not entitled to charge for this ride, but that it's so repulsive to Jewish values that you shouldn't even accept if the person offers, that's a big chiddush. That's kind of importing the idea of Kofan Al-Midas Dom into this, which some Rishonim would support that chiddush, but that's a little bit of a question. What exactly is the nature of this limit? I think Shlomo was up first.
This actually, this is what I was going to ask. Sort of, what is the qualification in the sense of saying that, meaning doing it as a parnasa or someone getting paid, meaning like an example that you were going to give about the car, right? If someone, let's say, says that he has a standard rule that any time he gives someone a ride, they have to chip in for gas. In his mind, you know, this is a rule, this is part of the, you know, whatever on the car. But hypothetically speaking, would that fall under this concept of...
So it depends also, I think, also an issue that some of the Rishonim raised, and it's also a good question whether or not this really even fits the model of the Bava Kamma Gemara, which Hadar B'chatzu Chaveiro is in Bava Kamma, the other one is Bava Basra. Whether that this even follows the model of the Bava Kamma Gemara is an interesting question, because maybe we should also distinguish between before the fact and after the fact. Michael, did you want to ask about that? So the question is also, what about before the fact and after the fact? So let's say, instead of the example we gave before, you come back from your vacation and your neighbor tells you that you spent some nights in your guest room, but let's say you call up your neighbor from your trip to Florida, and your neighbor says, oh, hi, funny you should call, you know, I was about to head over to your house, I'm planning on spending some nights there. And you say to him, I don't want you sleeping in my house. So most of the Rishonim assume, Tosus and Bava Basra and Bava Kamma, and most other Rishonim assume, that much you could for sure do, that much you could say, that before the fact I can tell you not to come into the house. It's only after he already did it that maybe I'm not allowed to charge, but I certainly have the right to say that you can't use it to begin with. There is a minority view, the Rav Yah, Mordechai quotes the Rav Yah, somewhat of a surprising position. He says that you can't even do that, that that's what Zen and Nevzel Ochasr means, that you're not allowed to prevent someone from benefiting from your property if it won't cost you anything. And again, you have to really make the hypothetical as such that there is no cost to the person at all. But if that were the scenario, if you could make it in such a way, so then the owner wouldn't even have a right before the fact to stop the other person from using it. Michael?
Could you argue that the one, the guy who's coming into your house and sleeping there, he actually has an obligation to pay, maybe because of Basi Dayasha Bato, even if you have to...
So there are some poskim who say that. There is the minority view that says that, I think Trus Marsham says like that, but there is a view in poskim that says that even if he's not chayiv, it would be right to pay for it. Right. You don't find that explicitly.
The reality is that most people wouldn't like someone just coming and sleeping on their couch for the night.
Right, so like you say, again, the wouldn't like part, see that, that's why, again, this case is so hard to relate to in real life, because you say you wouldn't like because you're thinking it's an invasion of your privacy, you think that who knows what's going to happen coming into the house, so we have to really make this case very abstract, where you can have a model where there's really nothing else besides the fact that you want to deprive this person of benefit or you want to profit from the benefit that didn't cost you anything.
I mean, the car ride is a perfect case for that.
So I'll come back to that case in a second, because it's actually a little bit more complicated. But it's hard for us to relate to these cases because we think about it in real life. We simply wouldn't want somebody just opening the door to our house and sleeping on the couch because we think, okay, you know, we feel violated and we feel our privacy was compromised and we would have all kinds of other concerns. But in order to relate to what Sugya is talking about, we have to kind of hypothesize a situation where it's nothing like that, where the only issue is he used your stuff, he benefited from your stuff, and you want to either stop him from doing that l'chadchila, or you want to charge him after the fact. Amir?
Do you think before should touch upon psychological taxation of, they say he's not allowed to come into your house because, you know, it'll disturb the owner because he has a delicate thing, it's
a little bit relevant to what I was saying a second ago, that, you know, again, you know, there are different types of chitzronos. It's interesting that this position that most of the Rishonim take, that if you tell him not to, then you're allowed to stop him against the view of the Ravya. So the Ravya seems to see this as kind of the principle of Kofin and Zenen are really one thing, that you're just simply not allowed to ever stop somebody before or after the fact from benefiting if there is no loss to you. But some of the Achronim, if Gusman has an essay about this in a Sefer Kuntres Shirim, and others say different Rav Shimon Shkapta, something along these lines, that says that is a chisaron, that if I don't have enough ownership of my house, that I can't tell somebody if you can't stay there, so then that fact becomes a chisaron, that fact becomes a impinging on my ownership. That shouldn't that be the definition of ownership? I should be able to tell people whether or not they can come in to use it. So somebody who's going to refuse to listen to my telling them they can't come in and use it, so that's itself a chisar, and that's how some understand it. That's why you have that right. So that's a little bit similar to what you're talking about. So it's interesting, as I say, I'm going to contrast these two cases. So the case with the Darba Chatzah Chaveiro, you're generally assuming is a lighter case. It doesn't necessarily have to involve cruelty. It involves simply not being entitled to this profit, while the case of Baba Basra involves what seems to be a more spiteful attitude, so there is a distinction in that sense. But you also find some Rishonim who distinguish it in the other way, and who in some cases say that maybe we won't say Kofin by the case of Baba Basra about the dividing up the land, but we will still maintain the din of Zenen of Zelo Chatzar by the sleeping in the house, because sleeping in the house, you don't lose anything. Right, the person lived there and you just simply want to profit off it. But in the case of the land, so if you'll say, come on, give your brother the south side because it'll make him happier and you can take the north side. So still, I have a right to either side. I have a right to have a lottery that I should get side A or side B. And for whatever reason, whatever personal mishigas I have, I want to maintain that right. So to tell me I have to give up a right that I have, that's maybe a bigger fetish. Maybe as much as you could see it the other direction, that it involves more achzarius, but that involves you giving up something, and the case in Bava Kamma doesn't necessarily involve you giving up something. So there are those who distinguish in that sense. There is also a discussion in the Rishonim that if the person does create a chisaron when he's doing that, and everyone in the room so far has noted that there's probably some chisaron if a person lives in your house, so then the Shulchan Aruch says that, like most Rishonim, that you can charge him for that. But then it's an interesting machlokas Rishonim, that the view of the Shulchan Aruch is that then you could charge him the whole thing. You could charge him rent. If the Maisa, if he caused you some kind of loss, you can charge him rent. And there's a minority view on Rishonim that says, Mukhi Yosef, that says that no, you can charge him for whatever the loss is, but you can't still give him a hotel bill. So it seems like the majority view is basically saying that this whole scenario only exists when it's pure, no chisaron whatsoever. But once there's a chisaron, then you already have a business deal, then you already have a whole different structure of the relationship, and then you can impose the whole value of the stay on this person. It fundamentally changes the nature of the relationship. This issue, by the way, and its implications in other directions, you know, the kind of inverse implications, is one of the major sugyas that's also invoked in the context of intellectual property. And the question of using somebody else's intellectual property and the notion that one should have to pay for that. So the Tshuva of Noda Behuda, which is a very often cited source in later literature, the Noda Behuda talks about a case where you have somebody who wrote a commentary, I think, on the Mishnayos. So he hired a typesetter back then in the days when it was a much more laborious and expensive process to have typesetting where everything was done letter by letter in plates. So he hired a typesetter to print for him plates that he should be able to publish his Mishnayos on the top with his commentary on the bottom. So then after he did that, the printer decided for himself, he'll also publish a set of Mishnayos. Now that he has these plates that he made for this customer, he'll use these plates and he'll publish Mishnayos without the commentary on the bottom, and he'll issue a competing set of Mishnayos. So the Noda Behuda said that the printer doesn't have the right to do that. The customer has the right to stop the printer from doing this. And what's the logic here? Because you could say, all right, look, it's Zen Nen Vzelo Chaser, that a person commissioned something to be made, and now he doesn't need it anymore, so why shouldn't he let someone else use it for free if he's not going to use it anymore anyway? Why shouldn't he let the craftsman use it for free? So that would have been Zen Nen Vzelo Chaser, that which he paid for, so let the craftsman now use it because it doesn't end up being machaser him anything. But the truth is here there is a chisaron, the chisaron of profit. The person is going to compete with him in such a way that now he's going to suffer in his sales, even though this is not a classic chisaron in a halachic sense because it's a future chisaron. It's basically a business loss in the future. But that's enough to change the nature of the relationship. So therefore, it says in Noda Behuda, that's the implication, that Zen Nen Vezelo Chaser, I can't stop you. But if Zen Nen Vezelo Chaser, if you're causing me a loss by how you're being Nen for my stuff, then I can stop you. So this is often invoked in the context of intellectual property, that even when the person isn't taking an actual object away from you, so you might say, okay, listen, if I created something and it's out there, why shouldn't people be able to use it for free if they're not taking an item away from me? So the answer is, if that's going to impinge on my profits because of what they're doing, so then theoretically that could be parallel to what the Noda Behuda talks about, that's the implication of Zen Nen Vezelo Chaser, that this is Nen Vechaser, and therefore I'm able to interfere, at least the Chachila, I'm able to stop them from doing that. Hi.
Maybe slightly tangential, like when you talk about like intellectual property and
right, so that's the chiddush. That's why it's interesting. See, normally, and that's part of the difficulty with intellectual property halacha in general, because, and it is a little bit tangential, and I'm happy to talk about it at a greater length for a different time, but I'll just address it for a minute, that, you know, there are those who say, okay, but if I duplicate electronically your stuff, or I download something, whatever it is, so there are those who say that it's gezeila, or it's some kind of theft. And there are others who are uncomfortable with calling it gezeila, because gezeila normally means I have something, and you take it away from me, and I don't have it anymore. You have my physical item, and now I don't have it anymore. And in the case of copying my intellectual output, so I still have the same item that I had before, and you haven't taken anything physical away from me. Now, maybe you're taking away future profits, but as you correctly pointed out, that's not always considered a type of theft. So if I open up a competing store, or if I invent something that makes your invention obsolete, I'll also cut into your profits, but that's not called theft. So it's not necessarily a slam dunk that that's the right characterization. So it could be that this model that the Noda Behuda discusses is invoked davka for that reason, that it's not about theft, it's about using somebody's property in a way that could have been considered nothing, except that it ends up having some chisaron, even though it's not the kind of chisaron that we normally consider actionable. So it's not that you could sue for a loss of money like somebody was mazik your stuff, but it's that it's a chisaron that's recognized as some kind of a loss, enough to change the dynamics that this is not zenev, is alo chaser, and therefore the other person should be able to stop it. Again, you know, stop, it may mean only that he can stop it beforehand. It may mean that he can say, don't do this, and that Beis Din can impose and enforce that the other party is not going to do it. But maybe it wouldn't mean that he could collect after the fact, because it's not the same thing as gezeila. It's not like he stole money that you could have returned. Maybe it's just more about injunctive relief, about stopping him from doing this in the future. So that's a complicated sugya, the whole intellectual property. You could spend many, many hours talking about it, but this is one of the major parts of the puzzle. This idea of the Nodbihu's tshuva about Zenda Nevelo Chaser and its implications in the other direction is one of the major discussions that comes up over here. So there are a lot of implications of this whole sugya. As others point out, the Chalkes Yalav also points out that if the person is not just benefiting in a sense, you know, kind of passive, like he got a good night's sleep, but let's say he uses your property in a way that he actually somehow runs a business out of your property and he's profiting. Let's say he not only sleeps in your guest room, but he starts renting out to other people and he starts charging them. So then you certainly have a right to get a cut of that, you know, that the person is not simply benefiting in a passive way. Sorry?
Or telling him to get out of it.
Right, or to stop it. If a person is actually profiting, then you may decide you'd rather get a cut, but that you should certainly be entitled to charge for that if it's something that goes beyond something, or if a person is, you know, profiting in any kind of actual physical takeaway kind of way, that's not just he got a good night's sleep, but he's coming away with some tangible benefit. And many of the poskim understand that that would not be a zenden of zelo chaser kind of situation. So this leads to a whole discussion the later poskim have, that the Netziv has a tshuva about this. He has basically a suffix about this. This is in the tshuva's Meshuv Davar and Chelik Beis and Simin Tzadi Dalit. Tzadi Beis maybe. Tzadi Beis or Tzadi Dalit, where he discusses the question. It's a short tshuva, two or three paragraphs. He says, so Lamaisa, should we say that a person is compelled to do chesed? If a person can do chesed in a way that doesn't cost him anything, so is he basically subject to being compelled under this rubric of kofen al midas don? And he has essentially some kind of suffix about this. He notes the Gemara Rav Kama and Daf Pe'alef. The Gemara talks about the institution that Yehoshua put into place, that somebody can't stop people who are trying to avoid the rain, the bad weather, from walking on their pathways, even if they're private pathways. It's not going to cause them any problem. So he suggests that's possibly the whole mucker behind Kofan Almida's dome. But that only tells you that you can't stop somebody else from benefiting when you're a passive. Can we say that you are also mechuyev to do chesed? He's not 100% sure. He notes in that tshuva that he wrote in the Hei Nekshal in his commentary to the Shaltas, that he thinks that that was also the logic behind the famous Mishpat Shlomo, that when Shlomo HaMelech was able to decide the din between the two purported mothers who were claiming to be the mother of a child, and he said, okay, I'll cut the baby in half. So one mother was okay with that. So this is the Midas Stone that he was identifying. The idea that I don't care so much whether I benefit as long as the other person doesn't benefit. So that's essentially a concept in line with this whole Midas Dom. He makes reference to that there as well. So this is a discussion whether or not you can impose an obligation of chesed. And so we made a reference before to this idea of giving somebody a ride. So the truth is, as I said, it's a little more complicated because l'chari you could say beforehand, I just don't want to give you a ride. And that would be comparable to the whole machlokas rishonim about saying, I don't want you to live in my house, where it seems that we paskin, you can say that. Even if you say you can't say that under normal circumstances, that even those who say that a person can't stop you from living in the house, they assume that if there's any way a person could profit from it otherwise, even if he doesn't normally set himself up as a hotel, but he says, okay, you know what, I realize you want to sleep there, I could charge someone else to sleep there, but then for sure he should have a right to say, I have the ability to profit from somebody else. So you either pay up or you're getting kicked out. So presumably that's true here as well. A person can decide on the spur of the moment he's going to become a taxi service, and he should be able to charge. I remember in discussions once with the Shechter, I mentioned this notion about the ride, and he also had said that a person could decide right then he's a taxi service. Maybe going off his view in the Rishonim, that should be a person's right. So the Lamaisa, should we say that a person is obligated to provide chesed for somebody, or let's say to provide a ride? So there's an interesting exchange of letters about this. Joseph Lieberman, and not the senator, but the posik, Shuvas Mishnas Yosef, is written by Rav Yosef Lieberman. He's a mechaber who is well known for his sefer on Shemitah, and Shvius is a multi-volume work called Mishnas Yosef on Shvius. But he also has Shuvas. He has many beautiful Shuvas under the title Mishnas Yosef. So there is an exchange of letters that he had there between him and Rav Leo Schlesinger, like I mentioned yesterday. We were talking about it a day or two ago. His sefer on Hanukkah, Ner Yishabeh, so we recorded the other day. So he has a letter which they have exchanged back and forth to the Mishnas Yosef, to Rav Yosef Lieberman, about this question. Should you say that if somebody has the ability to give somebody else a ride, he's obligated to do so? So the Mishnas Yosef, he didn't think that it was so clear, but it seems like they're really arguing about Messias, they're arguing about reality, and I think, if I remember correctly, he has something like 11 reasons in the Tshuva where he says it's not so clear that this is a Zenen of a Zevel Chaser kind of situation. Because maybe you'll lose some time by allowing the other person to get in and out of your car. Maybe you'll miss a green light by letting somebody else get in and out of the car. Or what's much more practical, and people to be aware of this, you know, maybe it's an issue of privacy. Maybe the guy is driving with his wife and this is the only time they have to be alone, and now you're going to get a ride with him and now they can't talk. Or very relevant nowadays, maybe the person does all his cell phone calls in the car and he does his business in the car, and now he's not going to be able to do that because somebody else is in the car. So he writes, he can think of many legitimate reasons why a person would not want to give somebody else a ride. And maybe he doesn't trust the person's germs, whatever it is, he can think of a number of reasons why, I think he has 11 reasons, why it is that it's not so clear to him that it's a lo chaser kind of situation. Does somebody want to comment on that?
Yeah, in a case like that shoe, would someone asking for the ride be over would there be an issue? They ask for the ride because, assuming that people are holding, they may feel the person who might feel the obligation to say yes, but not might not actually want to say yes.
Right, so that's a concept in general, that if you believe, if there really is some type of value to what you're asking for, right, so then the Gemara says the concept of avak gazela, that if you put somebody in a position where they're only giving you something of value because they feel socially uncomfortable otherwise, so it's a Gemara we actually saw last year a little bit, the Gemara in the second part above Mitzia. There's a Gemara in Kedushin, which takes it a little bit further, it makes it actually sound like literal gazela, but so it's some form of gazela. The comparison basically is as opposed to gneva, when you sneak something out of somebody's property. So gazel means that somebody gives you something willingly, but not really willingly. Like you put a gun to someone's head, and you say, your money or your life, so they give it to you willingly, but it's not really willingly, because the choice between dying and giving it over is not a real choice. So that's the whole yisod of gezel, is that the person is giving it to you, but they don't really want to give it to you. So therefore, you could understand why it's somewhere within the same category on a much lower level. If a person gives you something because the alternative is social embarrassment or whatever it is, so again, they don't really want to give it to you, but they feel pressured to. It's not the same as having a gun to your head, but it's somewhere along the spectrum. So that's why it's considered to be a avak zela. So theoretically, if there's any real value in the item, and if you're all the cheshbonus that the Mishnas Yosef has, if you're imposing those discomforts on a person, so that would certainly be wrong. But if it's a situation where it's really zenden nevezel ochaser, so then there probably are Rishonim who would say that, yes, the chachilo okay to use this. If it's literally 100% lo chaser, it's not going to have any type of a lack of impact on the person. So, but again, what basically seems to emerge though between this machlokas, between Rav Yosef Lieberman and Rav Schlesinger, it really seems to boil down to a machlokas in Metzias, you know, that they're just arguing about whether or not this really should be described as a mo chaser type of situation. But it kind of leaves open the question that the Netziv was mesupik about, that do we say that zenden nevzol chaser doesn't just mean you should passively allow people to benefit, but that you should actively be required to do chesed under these circumstances. It does seem many poskim do note that giving somebody a ride when you're willing to do so is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of chesed in general, but also of hachnasas orchem. But hachnasas orchem doesn't just mean taking somebody into your stationary house, but taking somebody into your vehicle, and could be hachnasas orchem and levaya at the same time. You're hosting them and escorting them to their next location. It's normally two steps, but it clearly is a chesed of use, and it is a value. It's just a question of whether or not somebody can be compelled to do this. So this is a very important sugya in general, just about out of time. Just want to reemphasize that this goes to the heart of what the parasha is about, that Avraham Avinu is a figure of chesed, and that he is the one who, and we'll see this more next week, this is really the very explicit opening theme of Parshas Vayera, but this is Avraham's motif in general, the value of chesed. And here we have, in this week's parasha, Lot, on some level, can't shake that quality. He's a host of people in Sdom. But at the same time, his own personal desires overcome this midas ha-chesed, and he joins up with Sdom, and Sdom is about the opposite. Sdom is about not necessarily theft, per se, but about a attitude that is completely devoid of any kind of chesed. I'll just close on one point. I talk about this sometimes in my Sai Sims class. If anyone remembers from there, that in general there's always a debate, you know, is the Torah capitalist or is it communist? And you know, the truth is it's probably neither, somewhere in the middle, but some suggest in the concept of Parshanus that we find in history, this is described in the Torah, the pendulum going back and forth. That, for example, we know the Dor HaMabul we read about last week was destroyed, among other things, because of Chemdas Mamon and Hamas, and if you look at the way it's described, what might be exploitative tendencies. Some will say that that's a perversion of capitalism, the capitalism taken to the extreme, that exactly the way it's described by communists in its worst sense, so that the Dor HaMabul represents a very capitalist society to a tremendous fault and was destroyed for that. And then at the end of the Parshas Noach, you have the tower, so the people building the tower, they seem to be communists. They all get together and they join in the socialist endeavor to kind of challenge God, and that seems to be a extreme communist version, rather. So that's also condemned. That's also criticized. So we had the pendulum swinging from a bad type of capitalism to a bad type of communism. And then you get back to Sdom. Sdom is also kind of a capitalist society, although there are those who interpret it the other way. There are those who see it as kind of a communist society. But Sdom is a capitalist society in the bad sense, that it's purely capitalist, that I get what I earn and you get what you earn, and that's it. There's nothing else in between. And what the Torah's vision probably is, I think it's fair to say, is that the Torah's ideal system probably is rooted in capitalism. We clearly have a concept of private property and money and the like. Chaznish commented that the belief that money is evil cannot be supported within halacha because we have mitzvos that require money. So we clearly have a concept of money, a concept of private property. So in its basic foundation, the Torah seems to be describing a capitalist society, but not one that is 100% purely capitalist in that sense. And is it, we don't really have societies like that in real life, and even in America either, because we always recognize that we have to modify the capitalist society with some type of social network and some type of a welfare system and a tzedaka and things like that. So it seems to be that that's really the Torah's ideal, that yes, it'll be primarily a capitalist system, but we'll have a Shemitah once every 7 years, and we have Maisros that are obligatory, and we have Trumas that are obligatory, we have Tzedaka that's obligatory. So we start off with a capitalist base, but we modify it in such a way so as to allow chesed and the like to properly express itself within, sorry?
Tax, 10%.
So the tax part is a little bit, it depends what the tax is for, but the notion that it's a capitalist society that's modified because of chesed considerations and some amount of socialist considerations, that seems to be the Torah's vision. So presumably stone is the capitalist society without that, without any type of chesed, and that is not only not our vision, but it's so alien that we're told that they get destroyed. And that we have as a principle of halacha that we should not allow that mentality to survive, and we would actually have our Beis Din enforce not being like Midas Tom. That's this notion of kofen al Midas Tom. So very important practicalities and very important values all derived from this week's parasha and the major discussions of the halacha, exactly how it manifests itself. A lot of practical details. Maybe we'll have an opportunity someday to look into this in a little bit more detail, but these are some of the Rosh HaPrakim that emerge from this consideration of avoiding the image of stone. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos.